This episode of the Talent Alpha podcast is brought to you by InfloAds. What is InfloAds, you ask? Well, it's a targeted, affordable ad network. It's easier to use than AdWords, and since spending hundreds of dollars to figure out which keywords work in AdWords, you can spend just a few hundred dollars and target your ad to specific communities of publishers. I like to target the web developer and web design communities for Talentopoly. I can add an image to go along with my ad, which I find increases my conversion rates. I usually get conversion rates of 0.3 to 0.6%, and if my ad is underperforming, the guys over at InfloAds will work with me throughout my campaign to try to bump that up and make sure that I'm getting great return for my money spent. They have high-quality sites like Forrest.com as publishers, and if you want to find out more information, I highly recommend you go check out InfloAds.com. Now let's get on with the show. You're listening to episode 16 of the Talentopoly podcast, where we discuss some of the best links posted on Talentopoly.com each week. I'm your host, Jared Brown.
And I'm Brandon Corbin.
Hey, Brandon, how's it going?
Hey, Jared.
So are you drinking some Jesus juice again this week?
I am, and actually, I'm going to be very boring because I'm drinking my cellar number eight.
Same one again?
Same one. I bought a few bottles of it, so I figured I'll just knock those back and then venture off to something new. I might not, though, because this is kind of nice. It's completely predictable. It's very good. What about yourself?
This is the longest that I think you've stayed on a certain type of wine during the podcast. It's a new milestone. All right. I'm having a Leinen Kugel Oktoberfest, which I think is what I had last week as well.
I'm doing the same thing.
Yep.
So this Vegas trip.
Yeah.
You went to Vegas.
No.
You're going to Vegas.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, with an intro like that.
Yeah, you can't beat that.
Exactly. So I've never been to Vegas before. I'll throw that out there off the bat.
Really?
Yes, never. Now, I'm not a big gambler.
No, you don't go to Vegas to gamble. That's stupid.
Okay. You go to Vegas to steal Mike Tyson's tiger, right?
you go to Vegas to forget.
Yeah.
And who are you going with?
I'm going with my wife and son, actually, my 20-month-old son. My wife's mother lives about 4 hours away in Southern California, so she's coming over for the weekend. She's got a room at the Bellagio, and she will be the perfect babysitter for us pretty much all weekend long. So
that is awesome. Now, have you figured out what you guys are going
to
do?
Yes. So we got tickets to see O, which is a Cirque du Soleil show, for those that don't know. On Saturday night, and I'm kind of excited because we got tickets to the late show, which starts at 10 o'clock. So that seemed kind of cool that they have a show starting at 10. I don't know why, but I just find that cool. Like, yes, we're going to the late show.
We are officially not old.
I know. So we're doing that. And my wife already told me, because she's horrible at keeping surprises. So it was killing her after she got my birthday present, trying to keep that a secret. And she told me, she blurted it out about 2 weeks ago, she got me 5 laps in a Lamborghini on the Vegas Motor Speedway.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
I am totally, totally pumped about that. And I get to take it up to 100 miles per hour on the track because they sent the whole pamphlet, the whole packet already, and I was going through that. And it's like, yep, you get to go up to 100 miles an hour. Not any faster. I think they govern the car.
Yeah.
But that should be pretty good.
I guess it depends on how long the straightaways are.
Right. It's a mile and a half long track, so whatever that works out to.
That'd be awesome. And when do you go?
Leaving Friday, get back Tuesday.
Right on. We're going to Chicago.
Nice. What are you doing up in Chicago?
You know, usually we take a vacation down to Gulf Shores, Alabama about this time of year. And this year just didn't work out for schedules. And so Emily was like, hey, we're going to Chicago. We leave Friday and we get back Sunday. And I have no idea what we're doing. I just hop in the car and I ride and she's got it all planned out. And the kids will just do stuff.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Do you know where you're staying, though, or do you just know no details? Total surprise.
I know the place starts with a W, but it's not the W.
Okay.
And maybe Witt, is that a place in Chicago?
I don't know.
Wynn? I don't know.
No, I think that's Vegas.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, but nonetheless, it should be a relatively decent time. Yeah, it'd be cool.
So do you frequently go up to Chicago, or when was the last time you went up there?
We used to have a client back when I had my ad agency. We had a couple clients up there, so we would travel up there all the time. And so I got really tired of driving up to Chicago just because it's such a miserable experience. But so I haven't been up there in 3 years, maybe.
One of my friends, actually, he goes up to Lafayette. So that's about 45 minutes from here. And he gets on a train with his family, and they just ride the train from Lafayette up to Chicago.
That's not a half bad idea.
Seemed kind of cool. Probably takes a little bit longer, but, you know, you're not stuck in a small car, and that seemed pretty neat.
Oh, that's a great idea. I'm going to have to look into that. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem. I actually took my son I went to two White Sox, Red Sox games, and I took him to one of them this summer. I think I talked about that on the podcast. Yeah. So that was the last time I was up there. I love Chicago. It is a nice place and a lot of great architecture up there.
For you architecture nerds?
I'm not really, but I do. I kind of get into it in Chicago. I don't know why, but I wouldn't say that I really am into a lot of architecture. I don't know a ton about it, but I do like going on the tours, and I did the architectural boat tour, which sounds incredibly boring, and like you have to be 60 years old to even apply for that, you know, to even get on the boat. But most of the people are older, but it was kind of fun. It was cool.
Sure. Whatever floats your boat, man.
Exactly. I mean, I'm just that boring. So there you go.
All right.
Let's get into the articles.
Let's do it.
Our first article is Yahoo announces cocktails, posted by Abelardo Gonzalez. I just saw this afternoon, so this is right off the presses.
Yeah.
Yahoo has a new web framework built using JavaScript. The main idea here is that it uses CSS3, JavaScript, HTML5, Node.js, UI, which is Yahoo's nice little Java library, and YQL, which is also Yahoo technology. And you write JavaScript code that can run in the client side and on the server side, so thus the Node.js part. And it will automatically optimize it for various screen sizes. So they show here in their cool graphic tablet and smartphone. You got mobile, so old-fashioned type phone, and laptop and all the rest of that. And they also announced a hosting platform called Yahoo Manhattan that you can host your cocktails on your cocktail apps. Yeah. So they're getting a little carried away with the theme here, but I like what they're doing.
Yeah, I think they might have a serious brand issue here, because just in this one article, we talk about three or four different new names that they're releasing for all of their different things. You have Mojito, you have Manhattan, you have cocktails, then you have whole bunch of other stuff. So I definitely think that they do need to figure out how they're going to make this a little bit more understandable, I think. But my God, it does look really cool. And the ability to just take your code base and compile it down into an Xcode project is pretty amazing.
Right.
Did you see the video on that?
I went through the introducing cocktails from Yahoo. Are you talking about the cocktails in action one?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the second vision. Check out the article. It's the second video on there. They go through and they show a running application, and it's just a simple, you know, I'm going to go grab some RSS feeds, and you can do sliding and all that. And he shows what happens if you have JavaScript turned off on your browser, and then it's all handled on Node.js on the server side. And then he shows, okay, now watch this. And he goes to the command prompt and he puts in his Mojito, you know, whatever Xcode compiler, and it opens up Xcode, and there's the completely packaged up, ready to go. And you hit run, and you basically have yourself an iPad app.
Which you could distribute in the App Store.
Exactly. And they talk about Live Stand, which is a Flipboard like news reader, and it's pretty amazing considering that almost all of it, it's meant to be across platform, and that it was built using, you know, the JavaScript technology, because it's pretty cool. Now the app itself, like, I wouldn't be giving up Flipboard for it, but I think that comes down to their usability decisions that they made. But nevertheless, it looks like it's a really, really powerful platform, and I'm a huge fan of YQL. So yeah, I was blown away. I can't believe I didn't see this until, you know, I started going through our show notes.
Yeah. Well, I saw somebody had literally just put this up on Talonopoly. So they
want to get into the cloud. They want to get into the cloud service, and you know, you power your stuff using their infrastructure, and they've got, yeah, very cool stuff.
So the iPad app is actually running WebKit in it for parts of it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I assume that they're kind of doing something like a phone gap or a Appcelerator does, where, you know, they kind of have the bindings for the different JavaScript
right.
stuff.
Yeah. So you could have a left hand side navigation sidebar deal, and that's going to trigger calls in the actual, could interface with the DOM and stuff. I did go yeah. through just a slight bit of that, and they said they can monitor what's going on inside the DOM and handle things natively. But a lot of what's being done is it's simply just running this JavaScript code inside WebKit.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's pretty fast. I mean, it was overall, I would say I would give it a 6 out of 10 for, you know, a functional app. But that, you know, for being mainly a, you know, preview version of the technology, pretty impressive.
So just to go through the names here, because I think I might be a little confused too, but mm-hmm. Cocktails is the overall umbrella of all the, like, these cool different frameworks and technologies that they're going to have. And Mojito is specifically the first cocktail they're releasing, which is JavaScript web application framework. That's how I understand it.
Someone was really drunk when they decided to come up with all this.
Yeah. And I think programmers, they have, you know, I think programmers are somewhat, you know, compared to designers, maybe the imagination department that may be a little lacking in. So, you know, coming up with themes, like, we're going to name all of our servers after Greek gods or Simpsons character. You know, it's a very common
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
So here they're like, we'll do cocktails and that'll seem really cool. And we'll just start with Mojito because that's great. So.
But then you have Manhattan.
Yeah,
and Manhattan. Is Manhattan a drink or is it a, you know, it's not right. a mojito, you know, I think they fucked up their metaphors.
I agree. I mean, I think here they mean it's the cocktail Manhattan, but yeah, it's a little strange. So, yeah, there hopefully will be other cocktails coming from Yahoo that we can all get drunk on. So, looking forward to that. Let's move on to our next article. On-off switches, a look into their user experience design. Quick little run through what this guy's talking about here. And he's talking about those toggle on-off switches you see a lot in Mac apps.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen them on the Mac desktop before. And of course, they make a huge appearance in iOS. So he's looking at, you know, if you ever have tried to do an on-off switch in one of your projects, have you ever done one of these in a project?
All the time.
Okay. So you know some of the issues you might run
sure.
into.
Sure.
It's surprising because when you think, I'll do an on-off switch, you just take for granted so much about what it's going to look like, users are going to interact with it. And it really, if you don't do it right, it's going to confuse the heck out of some percentage of your users, right?
Yep.
Because they won't know, like in this initial example,
Is it on or is it off?
Yeah, here's the on and here's the off.
Yeah.
So one is grayed out, one is whitish. So it seems kind of obvious which one is which, but
because again, it's one of those things where if it's one of those drawings that you have two pictures that if you look at it one way, you see one picture and you look at it another way, you have another.
Right.
And you can, and that same exact thing happens. It really happens when you have, you know, just a Boolean with the human brain. So yeah, it's amazing how much of a pain in the ass that can be where people are like, oh, well, let's just do a radio button. Or then you have two elements that you have to deal with. Or it's a good article. I think, I don't know. I think Apple's solution has been the best that I've ever seen so far.
Well, and they have a couple though.
iOS 5s.
iOS 5s. Yes.
Yeah, iOS
Which,
5. Cause
that was one of the biggest things I noticed as soon as I installed iOS 5 is that they changed that.
I mean, because it gives you the state of now. I don't know if this would have made a whole lot if the new so the difference between iOS 5 and iOS 4 was iOS 4, I believe, had both labels on there, right?
It did.
So it had and off, but it did show that one was very much a slider and it was over. Now with iOS, it just has the state, so as on, and then you click it, and then it, you know, the
it
ball
says
moves
what
over.
State it's in.
Yes. Now what's interesting though is it'd be I don't know if we didn't have the predecessor. Would this make as much logical sense to us? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a point.
But maybe not. So, but again, I do think iOS 5 really does at least get us to a closer point of, you know, that, yes, this makes sense to me. This is on, and especially when I see it next to four or five others that are off.
You know what it reminds me of now is the vacancy or no vacancy on an airplane bathroom door.
Yeah.
For iOS 5. Yep. That's, I mean, I feel like I'm moving that, like, and it's not going to slide across real easy. I'm gonna, like, jerk it across. Like, I don't know if it really locked or not, or somebody's going to come busting in here. Finally, the time machine one. So the switch for time machine that he gives is this final example.
Yeah.
I think this one is pretty bad because if you click on, it will toggle it. So if you click on either one of the states, it toggles it to the other side, which doesn't really work like a switch. And it says the on kind of highlights, but I don't, this just doesn't seem like the best sort. This doesn't look or work really like a switch works.
No.
This really is just a two different states. So yeah, why even do it that way? I don't think
they spent that much time on it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I agree.
Little nitpicky stuff up top I still enjoyed. Like the, it says enable history on off, which you don't really need to say enable there. That kind of confuses things. Because you don't know, well, is this something that will happen or is it like immediate or, you know, so just say history on off. You don't need the word enable. Don't get too verbose in your interfaces.
So, thank you.
Yeah, there you go. That's my tip for the day.
This is then where Steven would talk more.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We didn't even really talk about that, but Steven is doing something more important right now and could not make the podcast, so. Hopefully we'll have him next week. He'll be able to talk about all kinds of great stuff on the podcast. Article number three. I swapped MacBook for an iPad and Linode. This is posted by Paul Giberson. You want to walk us through this one, Brandon?
All right. Yeah. So this one's actually there's not a whole lot of articles out there that kind of, you know, make me challenge everything that I've ever thought before. And this one kind of did where the guy basically says, okay, I'm giving up my MacBook Pro and I want to start developing right on an iPad and using Linode. How do you say it? Linode?
Linode, I would think, yeah.
Linode, and I assume that's 512 meg RAM, whatever. Basically, a virtual server and my iPad.
And at this point, you're thinking, what an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Because, again, we all know that the iPad's great for consumption, but it's not very good for production.
Right.
And but what this guy goes through, and he goes through all of his different things, how he sets up his how he sets it up, where the things he has with – he has an iPad 2 – he bought the Apple wireless keyboard, an adjustable angle stand, ISSH, which is a $10 app on blah, 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 on the phone.
Sounds like a pretty incredible iOS app.
It is. I bought it.
Nice.
And he's got his virtual server running Ubuntu 11 and the Apple VGA. So he's looking around $800 plus $20 per month. Now, what I said is like, well, okay, again, I use Rackspace. So I just, you know, I have a $10 a month server that would just be perfectly fine for it. And I just went and set one up.
Is that a VPS or shared one? VPS?
Well, it's just part of the Rackspace cloud. So I really don't know. I just say new server.
Because I think what this guy's doing is he has full root access. So like this.
I have full root. Well, again, so, yeah, I've got full root access on these virtual servers that I get from Rackspace.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so I log in through it and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't, but I can. But what was really cool, and he just goes in through a lot of detail. He uses Vim as his editor. And this is where I kind of fell apart because, again, you know, we've talked about Vim. It's like the exact opposite of where I started when I started kind of thinking about developing for the web. So now I'm looking at it saying, okay, maybe I can get into it where I could be hyper productive in it and really start thinking about leveraging it. But right. He basically connects through his SSH to his Linode and he brings up all of the stuff that's already saved, his whole development environment, quote unquote, you know, using the Vim environment. And then, and he goes through and he's got VNC running on this and he can move around with his cursor using again, the ISSH,
Yeah, because that's the strange thing is he's actually one of the things he's developing for this company that they're doing in a team is this actual GUI for debugging. It's a graphical debugger. So he's got to be able to test this thing on his iPad.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about using Skype. you know, for the different meetings that he has. And it really just got me thinking about, well, hell, you know, maybe I could. Like, I want to see how far I can get. You now, again, I'm not going to be designing. You know, I'm not going to be breaking out fireworks or anything like that to really come up with, like, the visual stuff. But pretty much everything else, I think I can. So after I bought this, again, hopped to Amazon, bought myself the wireless keyboard. I bought ISSH and got it all connected and got that set up. I still am not sure about a stand, but yeah, I said, you know, let's see how far I can go with it. And so I'm definitely going to try to, because I've been using it as my GPS now. I've been using it for listening to music on my way to work. I've been using it for my audiobooks. I'm just kind of, let's see how much I can actually use this thing opposed, you know, for both production and consumption. So I'll be interested to see how the keyboard does.
And we kind of skipped over this, but the impetus for him to do this was that his MacBook Pro's file system got trashed. And he lost several days of uncommitted code, which I'm not sure why he was waiting days to commit code, but
yeah,
he lost it and he said never again. And now which I didn't quite get that part of it.
I think he backed into that story, if you ask me, because it sounds he's like, you know, I'm sitting there and saying, you know, I want to see if I can do this. And, oh, well, now I need to come up with a good reason why. And so I can see back that. Into it.
Because his Linode server could crash, too, just exactly. The same way. Exactly. I mean, he hasn't gotten completely away from that ability.
Yeah. I mean, my whole thing is I want to see somebody be hyper productive on this tablet, because it does eventually give you. It can give you that freedom. Again, if you have a MacBook Air, maybe not as much, but again, it's more, can we do it?
It's cool too, because he could just disconnect, he said, and then in the morning he just reconnects to his SSH and his Vim.
Yep.
So it's right where he left off. If he needs to go to lunch, he starts a long compile. He can turn off the iPad, go to lunch. It's compiling on his server, of course. And he doesn't have to worry about any of that. It's not bogging down his iPad. So,
yeah, that's pretty awesome.
It is pretty neat. I'm not sure that the other thing, though, is the smaller screen. And he did say that he uses that VGA connector and he can connect it to a TV. And he does that later in the day just to kind of play around with stuff. But he really looks like he's working mainly on the 9-inch iPad screen all day.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure I'd be too cool with that.
I've gotten used to the 13.
Yeah.
And I work.
It could work.
Except when I'm at home. Yeah. When I'm at home and I feel like I need to be productive, I plug it into my big monitor. But then when I'm at, you know, my work. Anyway.
This does seem to go back to what Ryan Dahl had written about, the guy that started Node.js, and we were talking about how he hates all software because it's gotten too complex. I do like that he's using a text editor, not a full-blown IDE. He's using something that doesn't have the equivalent of activity monitor. He's not having to kill processes or, you know, he's really gone back to a more basic setup, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. And we might all find, oh, my God, look how productive I am when I'm not getting constantly, you know, bombarded by Reddit in the other screen calling me.
Exactly. All right. Next article. Article number 4, awesome user interface design examples you need to see. And I think these really, we can just kind of talk through some of these and some of the stuff that you think is cool in this. We'll just try to describe it to our listeners here. The first one that really caught my attention was the 76 synthesizer concept. Did you see this one in here?
Yeah, that's the first one. No, that interface I would say is probably one of the best interfaces. Now, again, as far as the usability goes on it, I don't know until I'd start playing with it. But as far as trying to mimic the feel of the physical world, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, this looks beautiful. like a nice piece of analog hardware on your screen. They've got the beautiful brushed metal knobs. It actually has the little jack inputs on there, and you can virtually connect those. You've got that analog multimeter type interface.
It's got a glowing tube in it.
That's sweet. Yeah. And they just did a great job. And it looked probably all vector graphics just beautifully done.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, is that an app that you've ever seen anybody use?
No, but I don't hang out with a lot of musician types. But
Audio heads,
yeah. But yeah, I would love to, like, I wouldn't even probably use it, but I would even think about buying something that just looks that beautiful.
It's just so pretty.
Yeah. Just sit there and connect those jack inputs and outputs. Be like, yeah, I'm doing something. It's awesome. So what was one that caught your eye in here?
You know, there's a lot that didn't, honestly. The one that interested me, but then I actually started looking a little bit more into it, was the Locus, the location-based interface. And again, I like the idea of having a big display, but then I realized, oh, well, actually, this isn't even for the iPad. But it's got a pretty nice kind of big, I like the big 10-foot kind of view of how people have to simplify what they've got on the screen to make it super, super simple.
Right. Now is this what is this? Is this Android?
Yeah, this is no, it's either Android or it's Windows. No, it's not Windows. I think it's Android.
Okay.
And it's basically kind of like, you know, your TV view. Or I mean, I'm sorry, your GPS kind of in-car view where you've got the big time, you've got your music, your GPS, and all of that.
And they have nice icon metaphors. Music is this cool subwoofer part of a speaker. Favorites is an old-fashioned radio.
Yeah, and GPS is a nice folded map.
Yeah, the time. I always like it when they do that flip style. I don't know what you call that for the time. Where it, like the,
I call it HTC.
HTC.
Because they really mastered that with the Sense UI, is where you had that kind of, because it is, it's much more like in the analog clocks that you used to have, not with hand dials, but and again, that doesn't look very good compared to some of the other ones that you might see HTC come out with. But you know, going through, I really wasn't like blown away by a whole lot of these.
What about Mint? Do you like how Mint looks? I've always loved how it looks.
I do. I think they did a really good job. I mean, it's very clean. It's very comfortable.
But it still has vibrancy. You know, they still have color. It's not too washed out.
And it's got a shitload of information. And they do a good job for their information architecture that they have. But, you know, again, as far as being like revolutionary or, you know, awesome, I don't know. I guess I have higher expectations. I want to see some designer come out and just friggin' blow my mind, you know, coming up with a completely new way of thinking about, you know, architecting information. And
what about Infomotor Ticker UI?
I'm scrolling down. Which one is this?
Mint. It's under Mint a little bit. Infomotor. It's two under Mint. Right after FL Studio Mobile.
Oh, yeah. That thing made me about want to have a seizure. I'm not sure what all is going on in there.
It looks kind of interesting.
It looks interesting, but I guess it all kind of depends. So
I think it's got your tweets, it's got your news. Yeah, it's got, what's this third one, XJ900, and it has a target. I guess that's a specific stock or something, and the volume it's being traded at.
I mean, it looks like maybe Ticker is kind of, what's the other app that makes it so you can build your own chart platform and graphs and all that? But it kind of looks like maybe it's one of those. I don't know. Or it's just for stocks. Who knows?
About Camera Genius app interface. That looks pretty nice. I'd be very proud if I made that.
Yeah. Oh, well, hell yes. I mean, again, I would be proud if I made them. I think they did a really great job trying to pull out some of the old retro style camera. 80s, not like Polaroid.
Right.
Where you have just a slightly bent leather kind of material going on, and you know the plastic isn't super shiny on the button, so it's a pretty nice looking interface as well.
Yeah, it's pretty inspiring. The Alaska iPhone app is kind of unique. You know, they make it look outdoorsy, so it's got wood textures and cool old paper textures.
I'm calling bullshit on this one, though.
You don't like it?
No, I like it. I think they did a really good job of kind of keeping keeping the style with the user. But I don't think these are real screenshots.
Oh, what makes you say that?
The proportions are all wrong.
Are they?
Look how tall that is compared to its width.
That does seem a little.
It's almost like they took the bottom part and moved it down the width of the height of the bottom part again.
That is strange.
Yeah, it's definitely not the right perspective.
Maybe that's a mock-up. I don't know.
But nonetheless, it's a good one that people should definitely check out if you're looking for some good design inspiration.
Yeah, a lot of good design inspiration in here. All right, I'm excited to get to our next article here. Number 5, Codify, an amazing way to program on your iPad. This blew me away when I saw it. This looks like such a cool way, not just to learn how to program, even if you know how to program. It's something if you have an iPad, you need to check this out and try this.
So here's my question for you, though. What languages can you do on it? Is it specific to this Lua programming language?
I think it's only using Lua right now, which I've never actually done before, but they say they like it because it doesn't rely too much on symbols. It's a simple, elegant language, so it's great for the iPad. Great to just, you know, see in its editor here.
See, but I want Coda. I want Coda on my iPad.
Well, maybe they'll start supporting other languages.
I hope so.
Or maybe this is the beginning of other apps that kind of, you know, if this does well, I'm sure there will be other ones out there.
Yeah, because what's weird is this one, it seems like it focuses a lot on how it positions itself as a way to build kind of games.
Yes. I think they call it visual programs. So simulations and games are the main ones.
Okay.
That's what it excels at. That's what it's really made for.
I mean, but it looks like it's got some pretty cool stuff. You can test it right there.
Now, I found so neat.
But what can you do with it? Like,
well, the first thing I thought was really cool. App. Yeah. So and you can't distribute it.
Okay.
You can't share it with people because that's against the App Store policy, and you can't package it up and distribute it through the App Store. So the two things, just to get specific here, the reason that you cannot distribute a app in the App Store that runs as an interpreter, basically, to interpret any type of code, and you know, like a JVM would or something like that. You can't do that. That's against the App Store policy. So because of that, they're not allowed to build into this some way to like say, hey, email this program to another Codify user. Can't do it. And you can't package it up and put it out there. And they may be getting better about this because this is really a gray area right now. But they have not allowed people to build apps using Flash and then compile those into native iPhone apps and put them out there. They, at least for a while, were really cracking down on that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they lessened up on that.
I just don't know where we stand on that.
Today. Exactly. So again, it's a very cool interface, and I do think that a lot of people could take from this and say, oh my God, I didn't think about how I could leverage this and this and this touch features when you're interacting with your code.
Right.
But it seems like this is kind of like masturbating with no end. Right.
Nobody else will really be able to take advantage of what you've done.
Exactly. And it's kind of like, okay, well, now what? So,
yeah.
But I do think that they did really try to, they've completely changed the way that I look at how you could do code on the iPad.
Or really anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the fact that when in your code editor, so you say draw sprite is one of the things they show in here, and you click on that function that you just wrote, and then it comes up with this nice little gallery of the sprites that it has available, and you actually see them and you choose the one you want instead of in, you know, any other like desktop in code editing experience, you're going to have to find what the path is to it and type the path in correctly and everything. Mm-hmm. Right. This was like, no, you just click here. We know because it's the draw sprite method, but let's just pop open a gallery of everything that's in like your public folder basically. And we'll just, there you go. Just choose through it which one you want to be drawing right here. So that was kind of neat. You know, color, same thing. If you're putting a color value into something in your style property, there's a color picker. You just tap on it, choose your color. Now, when you're doing the debugging, that's what really blew me away. So you're running the app, you're testing it out, and in the bottom left, it had the output, so it's like your log file. But in the top left, it had parameters, which were sliders. So there were maybe you're trying to figure out, well, what's the frequency of the bullets being shot out by my little spacecraft? And that's one of your parameters you're trying to tweak, or how fast the screen moves, you know, how fast you're flying or something. You can tweak those things right there as you're debugging it, as you're testing it, and it's actually changing the value in the code. That blew me away.
Magical.
Yeah, it's totally magical.
They've got a great video. Highly recommend checking it out.
Yeah, it's $8. So.
But I wouldn't buy it.
I got it. I'm playing around with it some.
Are you?
Thinking, yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking that, you know, what I would love is if JJ, my son, gets into programming, if he shows an interest in this sort of stuff, if he's like 4 or 5, I could see him using something like this and getting really excited about programming because of it. So I like that aspect of it.
The guy's hand that's on the video looks very similar to mine. It's very creepy, actually. When you see a hand that looks like he's got a gigantic thumb like me. Anyway,
That is such a strange comment.
That is. I'm sorry.
So yeah, if you're interested in this sort of thing, go check it out. If you're like Brandon, then don't check it out.
No, don't. I think you should check it out. I just don't. Again, I wish that there was, you know. And now if they come out and they say, hey, now we have a way of you doing, you know, JavaScript, or yeah, you can do whatever, and you can connect to, you know, an SSH server somewhere or whatever, right, then I would be like, oh hell yeah, I'm all over it.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. I don't see why they couldn't do that. I mean, yeah, you can't run it on, you know, you can't distribute it to other people's iPads,
yeah,
but you can distribute it to a computer.
Yep.
So hopefully they'll be doing that. All right, moving on. Article number 6, redesigning gesture icons, posted by Abelardo Gonzalez. This interesting article talking about some, I guess this is user experience or user interface design,
read the article?
I did. How would you classify it? Like, what sort of design is this?
This would be icon design.
What does icon design fall under? Is that experience?
I guess it could be both, just your UI design or your, you know, your UX.
Okay.
It seemed like this guy really wanted to try to come up with something that could be really taken and build off of, where he can say, okay, I am the guy who created the standard for gestural icons. And what's interesting is every time I'm looking at it, all I see are eyes looking at me. And when you see it, you'll understand that you basically have this cartoon looking eye, but it's really the finger with the fingertip, and then the, you know, the eyebrow or the circle of the eye is representative of if it's a full click, if it's a zoom, or if it's a push.
I think it's a nun. It's a nun, like in a black.
It does look like a nun, doesn't it? It looks, that's a nun in a circle. And then if there's two nuns with two halos, then it's two finger tap. If it's got two halos, then, you know, so he goes through, and I think he did do a pretty good job of trying to come up with a global way that could convey the same meanings across all languages without it being, you know, specific to English or whatever.
The problem he's trying to solve? He kind of goes into that a little bit. You know, like you see the hand icon in a lot of these things, right?
Yeah. I don't know if it's that big of a problem.
Well, why not use the hand icon? What did he see as the problem with that?
That it was inconsistent. So you'd have different hands.
Because it's a right hand versus what if you're left-handed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, again, I don't know if it's as big of a problem that he's trying to solve. But, I mean, honestly, if you look at the two-finger swipe down, it is an owl.
Two-finger swipe down.
Primary two-finger gestures, where he goes through and it starts showing like two fingers up, down,
right. Yeah, I can see that.
But I don't know. Now, can we download these?
That's a great question. Does he not have them ready yet?
I don't.
Gesture icons. Let's see. No, there's another website. So there are other websites where you can go download these things, and it shows them. You know, the hand is what has always really been used before.
Yeah.
And what I love is that people take something that isn't that seemingly complex, or that other people just never really questioned it in user interface design, and they take one small aspect of something, carve it out for themselves, and say, I'm going to sit here and really think deeply about this and investigate. And you start to get into it and you're like, oh wow, there's a lot of things I can think about here. And if you really think about it, the way that we've been doing it has these broken issues. You know, it's broken. There are these confusing parts to it. And if you have a whole hand representing the tap, then that means 90% or more of the icon real estate is representing something that really isn't about the action.
Yeah, you know, all that matters is the nun.
Yeah, the nun is what matters.
And now, it's kind of like the on-off button, right? It's the same thing where you sit down and you say, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to just do a whole bunch of thought experiments on this one tiny little thing.
Right.
And this guy really did. And he broke it down, and I think he grasped all the things nicely. Again, I don't see myself, because I can't get past it looking like eyeballs.
Right.
It doesn't look like a finger to me.
So that would be your thing. Maybe you need to sit down. You need to spend the next couple of weeks
Yep.
working on the perfect finger icon.
Exactly. Yeah, it's got to look more like a finger. And I don't know if that's just adding a 10% gray where the, you know, the fingernail has a little bend above it or something. Right. But I think he's onto something.
I think so. It, you know, like another example here is the pinch to zoom thing, mm-hmm. that, you know, you try to illustrate that. How are you going to do that? Are you going to use the index finger and the thumb to show people to do it?
Yeah.
Or, that's not the only way. You could use two fingers from different hands.
Yep.
You could use your middle finger and your index finger, which is actually somewhat common.
I like to use my index finger and my penis. I mean,
I always use both middle fingers. I use my middle finger constantly while I'm using my phone in public. That's the way I do it.
Are you kidding?
Of course.
Okay, good. That would have been funny as hell, though.
It would be funny. I actually might do it now. But
oh, sorry about the ding there. That's me telling me that my wine just ran out.
Ah, that's bad news. Are you totally out now?
I might be.
Oh, no.
That's not good.
So, yeah, removing ambiguity, because when you just see these two fingers saying, move them apart, use any fingers you want. Use your penis if you want. It doesn't matter. Just move them apart.
Less confusing. But, hey, God bless. Who is this guy? PJ... Onori? Onori? At very top. Some random dude.
The very top here. Oh, yeah. PJ Onori.
Yeah.
And he covers design and technology in the broadest sense possible. Cool. Well, thank you, PJ. That was a delightful article. Moving on. Article number 7. jQuery mobile theme roller posted by Paul Giberson. This got my attention because I like what the jQuery mobile team is doing, mm-hmm. and this lets you very easily construct your own look and feel, your own theme, using the great theme roller that's built into jQuery for whatever mobile interface you're doing. Very easily. You can change colors, the corner radius. I wish that my web design worked this way.
No, this is pretty amazing. So I was going to give this a bunch of shit because it didn't. The funny thing is it doesn't work very well at all on the iPad.
Really?
Yeah, because you can't drag and drop colors. But now that I'm here,
But the output theme would work well.
Oh yeah. But the actual, you know, the actual thing. But this is actually fairly mind blowing. Where I'm dragging a color, I'm dragging brown, I'm dropping it on my hover state of on, and it's automatically making the color of the text white because it's a darker color. And I am building quite possibly the ugliest theme you've ever seen right now. But this is pretty damn amazing.
It's great. I want a web framework that has this type of theme ability in it with a nice editor that, you know, just comes with your framework. You're like, okay, time to style this sucker. Let's go to town. I want a GUI for styling stuff just to get in the ballpark of what you want. And then you can get into the nitty gritty inside the CSS and go crazy.
This is badass.
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
Really liking it.
And then what's A, B, and C? I guess I'm confused on that. It looks like maybe you can build multiple themes to kind of try them out.
Right. That's what it says, up to like 26 of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've just got some really ugly. Now, what this does do is it does make it so there's going to be a whole lot of ugly interface stuff out there.
It has this Adobe Cooler swatches. Did you see this up at the top here?
So I can just click it.
Yeah.
Nope.
No.
You can drag the colors. Drag the colors. Okay. Yeah, this is pretty neat. Especially if you're using jQuery mobile. I try to do a big project on it, but again, since I don't have control over the HTML, it made it almost significantly harder for me. So I ended up having to scrap it.
Right.
But this is neat.
And theme roller. Are you familiar with theme roller?
Other than what I'm downloading right now, where I just download the zip and boom, there it is. I just load it up. I throw my CSS on there.
Well, theme roller, you can, like, even if you're building plugins in jQuery, you can make them work with theme roller, and the good plugins will.
Well, sure, because they're going to be using the jQuery UI stuff, right?
Right.
Okay.
So, yeah, you can just very easily, and they have tons of great themes already made up. One of my favorite jQuery plugins is JS Data Tables, and it uses Theme Roller, so you could very quickly achieve a nice look for it. It's good stuff.
Very neat.
Yeah. All right. Next article is why we moved off the cloud at Mixpanel. And we talk a lot about cloud platforms, and you mm-hmm. see a lot of very pro cloud platform stuff out there. This article is very much against cloud platforms, at least sticking with cloud platforms as you scale your app up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest point of this article. So he goes through, and so he was using Rackspace, and he goes on and basically ends up, what the hell's the name of Flow?
Mixpanel?
SoftLayer.
Oh, SoftLayer, yeah.
Yeah, so they end up going with SoftLayer, which I guess
is Mixpanel, by the way, that's doing this.
Oh, okay. So, but now what's interesting is he goes through and he talks about, you know, the pros are obviously low initial cost, fast development time, hourly billing, cheap CPU performance. But then he goes through a lot of the problems, and his biggest problem really is the highly variable performance. So meaning that they were getting some really bad disk read times and it was just causing a lot of problems. What I think that, you know, and he does sum this up at the very end of the post, which I was glad because I was starting to get annoyed by it, that he's saying, you know, you really need to take and get dedicated hardware, but it doesn't work for startups, you know, and that's where it's like, okay, this all works fine and dandy once we have a bigger team, we have some money, and, you know, when these guys are, you know, getting some cash already throwing at them, it makes it easier. So I think it's like, you know, use the cloud to get up and to be able to build this all out and get it going cheap. But yeah, you absolutely need to have a migration plan because, you know, you're never going to probably stay where you started. That's right. Just kind of the natural progression of what an application is. And he finally does say that, you know, the I hope that this post can convince you at least one growing startup to consider dedicated hardware a lot sooner than we did. But I would say that it's not, that can't be the important piece of the puzzle while you're building out your platform.
Right. And you don't want high capital costs in the beginning.
Exactly.
You just can't afford it.
Yeah.
But you're like leasing hardware when you do cloud platforms, and that's going to be more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So as you know, if you go on a site like Heroku, and you play around with their pricing estimator, you realize that very quickly, if you were to build a larger site, you're going to be in the hundreds of dollars, if not $1,000 or more per month.
Sure.
And you might as well be buying hardware at that point. It doesn't, the cost, you'd think you reach like economies of scale as you got bigger on the cloud, but you actually don't. It doesn't scale as well as you'd think. The cost doesn't.
See, and the same thing goes though. Is then you're gonna have depreciation of that hardware. You've got a whole different accounting things that you got to take care of. The hardware is gonna get older, and it is eventually gonna fall apart. So you're gonna be responsible for replacing that. So there are a lot of pros and cons. Now, again, I can't agree completely with, you know, if you're seeing, you know, radical performance changes in your hosting that you can't control. Then, and if that's in their case, they're analytics, right? I mean, they're do you actually know anybody who's using them?
I see a lot of Y, because I think they're a Y Combinator startup.
Yeah.
So I do see a lot of other Y Combinator guys using this stuff.
I'm gonna sign up for it. I'm gonna try it out. I like a lot of the stuff they're doing. I think it could be really great for a lot of the e-commerce sites that we have.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to know that they're obsessed about performance.
it reminds me a little bit of StatsD, which is what Etsy created, which is like just super simple. Like anything can spit out stats and just increment counters, and you can just get, it's like Google Analytics for everything you could ever want. And that's really cool. So you could have every controller action or, you know, everything spitting stuff out.
Well, let's ask you, right? So you're Heroku now. How much?
Yeah.
I mean, at what point would you say, okay, I do need to switch now to my own hardware?
Yeah, so I'm running two Heroku instances, which they call dynos,
mm-hmm.
which I think they said like four dynos equals a small AWS server instance. And okay. So I'm running two of them right now. And memory-wise and CPU-wise, that's not that much. You know, that's nowhere near like what you would just go out and buy if you buy a nice 1U HP server or something like what these guys might be buying at SoftLayer. You know, they're probably getting like eight dynos worth of performance out of one of those. And I'm using the shared Postgres SQL database, so highly variable performance there. And I am using WebSolar as my search infrastructure, and I have SendGrid to do my emails. So that comes in at about $70 per month, $60 to $70.
Damn, that's not bad.
It's not bad. I've really, and because it's like having an entire IT department working for me all the time. I don't have to manage my Solar instance. I don't have to manage anything. And I just do one button deployments with my Git, Push, Heroku. And I have a free staging server because I run one dyno and your first dyno is free. So my staging server is completely free. So that's great. And I pay $60 to $70. Now, if the site were to take off and I were to start to have to spawn up more dynos, and here's the other thing is you will eventually want worker units as well to do background processing, right? Background jobs.
Yeah.
And very quickly, you start to get into some expensive territory. You could get up to $300. You know, in the database, you know, what if the database really needs to be high performance? Their initial database package for dedicated database starts at $200 a month on Heroku. So yeah, you're going to be at $300-$400 easy once you start having to scale.
Yeah.
And at that point, it makes you stop and think.
Now, the what's funny, though, is I go back to, you know, 2000, 2001, when I'm working for a company called LMIV, which we were there to support, you know, all of the big radio conglomerates other than Clear Channel. And our hosting was $100,000 a month.
That is crazy. Wow.
We had $30 million invested in us. And, we tore through that. Like,
oh, I bet.
Going out of style. We were lighting $100 cigars with $100 bills.
Yeah. Luckily, those days are behind us. Hosting is much, much cheaper than that.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I'm sure they still would have screwed it up.
Now, one other thing to note, too, is that these cloud platforms, because you, unlike if you just do AWS, you do get an IP address. But if you do something like Heroku, where it's even more abstracted, you're not getting an IP address attached to each of your instances because you really are on a shared server at that point. They're running multiple dynos, which are these little virtualized OSs with your code on them, with, you know, using vHost technology, basically. Yeah. So you don't have an IP address, which means standard SSL certificate technology is not going to work for you.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that's where you get into some shit.
How does that work then?
They have a couple of options. They have the free option. If only you are the one that needs SSL, they have the piggyback option because Heroku does have an SSL cert. Now, you can just use theirs and you can go to the HTTPS for your Heroku app and it will work, but it will give you a warning saying this doesn't match your domain name, of course. Mm-hmm. But it will work. So if it's just you doing it, it's like your own little admin backend or just to do something, that'll work fine. Now, the problem is that there is a solution for cloud-based certificates that work in a vHost fashion, but Windows XP is not compatible with that.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So all your Windows XP users are going to get a warning message if you do that. That one's like $5 or $10 a month to do. I think it's called SNI or something. And then there are options above that, which are like $20 was another one. And if you really want to go the best way possible, you need an IP address, which means you need to spin up basically what's called a smaller, an extra small instance on AWS within the Heroku cloud, though. You can't just go use a separate server. It needs to be part of their routing mesh, which is their whole proprietary thing.
Yeah.
That's $100 is what they charge you to spawn up. Basically, it's like a whole, you know, server instance in their mesh that would have be populated by a bunch of dynos, but instead they're just using it to basically route SSL for you. And that's an extra $100 a month right there. So that's a huge problem.
Yeah. I didn't realize that that's how that all worked because I've been with Rackspace, and with Rackspace, it's literally, okay, create a new server. What size do you want? What operating system do you want?
Right. That's very much the AWS method.
Exactly. Except for it's a lot easier than AWS. I really didn't like AWS. But then again, so you have your IP, you have root, you have everything. Yep. So you're responsible for SSL, no problem. Yeah, exactly.
Heroku is like, don't worry about anything. When it comes time to push your code, do a Git push Heroku and you're done. Or Git push origin, depending on how you've set up your Git remotes. So, you know, it's a different thing.
Sure.
But okay. Next article number 9, on programming deadlines. This, programming deadlines is just a part of the business. Unfortunately, you can't really get away from programming deadlines. And this article talks about some of the things you should be doing, or you could be doing, to help yourself exceed or meet your deadlines. Does a lot of the projects that you work on, Brandon, do they have deadlines?
They always have deadlines. But in our case, specifically at where I work, a lot of people are really slow, and Patrick and I are insanely fast. So our whole stance is, okay, well, what's your deadline? And they tell us, and we just kind of snicker. We're like, yep, no problem. So yeah, we rarely get pushed up against a deadline now. Like a lot of the developers, though, they are always getting crammed with it. So this is a good article for them, and I will admit that I didn't read this article.
Okay, well, let me walk through some of the things he says. He states these as rules. These aren't just tips. These are rules you should follow. Yeah. These are the rules of Fight Club. So rule one, set up continuous deployment before writing any code. So I'm guessing this guy is pretty big TDD style developer. I don't know if this is a requirement. I mean, I don't think every project needs to have a continuous deployment environment set up for it, but he's saying that this is huge. At the very least, he does say that you need to set up your staging and your production environments ahead of time, get your testing environment set up and working. And, you know, doing that up front, you're going to use them sooner, which is just going to save you time when you're using your testing environment or when you're pushing code to staging and like, oh, I didn't really get staging set up, or this is just my demo server for now, so I don't really have a production. That kind of gets muddy. Set those up beforehand so you can start using them properly. And then he, says, well, of course you should be doing your continuous deployment as well. Have you done continuous deployment servers before, Brandon?
No.
But explain
it to me.
Okay. So continuous deployment, and I haven't actually done one myself either. So we're about to do one on a project that I'm working on. I'm kind of excited to get my feet wet with it. What the concept behind it is, so you've got all these unit tests that you've been writing, and hopefully you've got good code coverage with those. Now, whenever you're going to check in some code, you're going to do a commit into your version control. It should have a post-commit hook that will then check that code out to another server, which will automatically run through all of your suite of tests. And if any of them fail, it should notify the team that there has been it has failed, and which tests specifically failed, so that as soon as a build is broken, everybody knows that it's broken. That's really the beauty
that makes,
of it.
Yeah, that makes complete sense.
And then that way, because if you're doing a really long, big, extensive suite of unit tests, it's going to take some time to run. You don't want to do that locally. And if it's up to you, you're not going to do it every single time. So just let some other server automatically do it whenever the code changes. That's the beauty of it.
I like that.
So he's saying do that, and you won't have to worry at the end of the project that a whole bunch of your code is still broken, because if you're writing tests along the way and you're continuously deploying it and checking it, then you know it works all the time and you're always ready to deploy it to production for a demo or beta testing. Rule number two, write tests first. So of course, if you're going to be doing this test-driven development style with continuous deployment, you need to be writing great unit tests. So make sure you're doing that. Rule number three, be transparent, which he's saying is greatly beneficial here, to have good communication, clear line of communication to your clients who are receiving your code. Keep them updated very regularly as to what you're working on, the progress you're making. That way, if you run into any problems, you're letting them know as soon as you're running into those problems that maybe the deadline might be affected, or why it might be affected, and just keeping them up to date along the way is much better than waiting a couple of weeks and then telling them, that deadline that's coming up in a week, not going to be able to make it. They're going to feel like maybe you weren't working that entire time, or, you're just working on other stuff, or, whatever the situation is, there's room for their interpretation and you don't want to allow for that. So rule number four, maintain daily to-do lists. To-do lists are great. You should use them. That's at least the one tip in here, that even if you're not doing test-driven development, that you should definitely be doing. And rule number five, the last one, do the right thing, which is don't procrastinate, don't skip writing unit tests, and make sure that you're treating your deadline seriously and actually trying to get the code done before the deadline. Be professional, I guess.
Yeah, there you go.
That sums it up right there. So it's some medicine for people to take, and it might taste bitter going down, but I think it's all good points on things you could be doing to help you stay on track. So
wonderful.
There you go.
Thank you, Jared.
No problem. Go. You're going to set up your continuous deployment server tonight, I expect.
Right? I am. No, actually, what I'm going to do though is I'm going to set up one of these Hubot factory thingies.
So what do you know what this Hubot thing is?
I have no idea, but I'm intrigued.
All right.
I was hoping that you knew.
I do.
Okay, so then tell me all about it.
Article number 10, build and deploy your own Hubot with Hubot Factory, posted by Arlo Carrion. Hubot was built by GitHub, and GitHub is a really cool atmosphere or, I don't know, developer-type relationships that they all have with each other at GitHub. They don't have a very hierarchical structure of what they're supposed to be working on. They all just kind of work on what they want. And as part of that, to try to stay in sync with each other, they use chat a lot. So they're using Campfire to chat amongst themselves throughout the day. And they don't have a lot of physical meetings. They just talk things out on Campfire. And if they need to jump into a separate channel on there, they do. Or they, you know, they talk about it as a team in there. There's a transcript that's saved out, so at any time, other people who weren't part of the chat could come and check out, well, what were they talking about, or get caught up with it. It's kind of a really cool dynamic, I think, to try to run your software team that way. And it's actually the way that I've been running a software team for a couple of projects that I'm working on for one of my clients right now. We set up a HipChat, which is very similar to Campfire. We are all working at different locations, so we are not... Actually, one of the programmers works on location with me, and the other two are pretty much never on location. So we're using HipChat to completely collaborate and share ideas and coordinate everything. And then we also use Pivotal for our issue tracker and task tracking. And Hubot is something that these guys at GitHub, they just work on in their spare time at work as kind of a fun way to just let off some steam and work on something together. So it's kind of like a 20% time project like you have at Google. So they've built this Hubot who just sits in their Campfire chats and adds a little bit of humor. You can teach them jokes. You can have them post funny images. You could probably, you know, you could write a little script that has them post funny images from Reddit into the chat. You know,
yes.
Cool stuff like that. And you just write scripts for him to have him do whatever you want. Now, there are actual useful benefits to him as well. Like going back to the continuous deployment server, you could have him monitor the continuous deployment server and not just receive emails when builds break. You could have Hubot actually maybe get kind of down and dirty and diss somebody in the chat room if they're the one who, you know, whose test broke or something, and, you know, have them diss somebody or at least notify the team inside the chat that, hey, the build just broke. Somebody needs to fix it, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You could tell him to go and run the test suite on the deployment server if you wanted. You could write a script that tells him, you know, you could just tell Hubot in some humorous way how to roll the code out to production. So your one-click deployment is actually done through Hubot in your chat room. You know, you could do all kinds of cool things with this. So I think the skies are really the limit here. It's just whatever scripts you want to write. And now that they've open sourced Hubot, you can just grab this and throw it up on something like Heroku if you want. And Heroku is free at its most minimal level, and I don't see why you would need anything more than the free account to really run this thing. So what Hubot Factory does, and this is, I've kind of put off using Hubot so far, but I think now I have to take the plunge. So with Hubot Factory, you can very quickly just type in some of your Heroku credentials, what you want the name for your Hubot to be, and what adapters you want. It'll work with email, Campfire, Flowdoc, GTalk, HipChat, whole bunch of other stuff. And you can just deploy this thing within like 5 seconds and have it working for you and your team.
I'm going through some of the community scripts now, and it's all written in Coffee.
It's Coffee script in Node.js, right?
Yep. Yeah, and they've got Bing searches, so you can ask it to do queries, and it's and the syntax is actually fairly easy looking, where you can basically say, you know, Bing, and then your query, and then it returns the results.
It reminds me a lot of some of these IRC bots that have been around for a while.
Yes, and yeah.
I know one of the most famous ones is the one that hangs out in the Apache channel. I don't remember the name of it, but that one's pretty cool because you can actually, and here's another really great use for a bot, you could teach it a knowledge base type things. So you can actually, if when people would come into the Apache channel and ask really rookie questions, the bot will be monitoring that stuff and can give you the nice responses, just like any knowledge base would.
Instead of some asshole telling you that you're a noob and that you should die.
Go read the fucking manual and everything. Yeah, instead, the bot will say, go read the fucking manual. And exactly, go read page 53. So I think that's kind of neat too. Within like a software team environment, it's probably not as necessary, but you could have stuff in there that you could have, you know, if you're going to be bringing new team members in, you could have your Git workflow trained into it so that people could ask it, how do I pull down, you know, or tell me the branches, Hubot,
yeah.
You know, and it could, boom. Here are the branches that are right now checked into the repo. How do I, you know, do a merge from a feature branch back into master? And it's like, here's how you should be testing that and do that. You know, that type of stuff would be kind of cool.
Yeah.
So really a lot of stuff you could do with this.
Very cool stuff. Great of them to open source it all too.
Yeah. I like it. I love GitHub. So that wraps up our episode for this week. You have any last words before we end this, Brandon?
No.
Got nothing for us.
Got nothing. Nothing.
Nice. Well, if you come up with something, you can always tweet Talentopoly on Twitter, Brandon. I encourage you to do that.
Nice.
And if you want to hear yourself on your own podcast, you can subscribe to this on RSS and Instacast. I bet you didn't know that, Brandon.
I didn't. I will need to check out, is that Instacast an iPhone app?
It is an iPhone app, and it's amazing.
And what if I'm on Android? What can I listen to the podcast on there?
Do they have Instacast on Android?
I don't know, but I know they have Google Listen.
Then you should use Google Listen.
Use Google Listen and subscribe to the Talentopoly podcast.
And if you use iTunes, Brandon, you can subscribe to the Talentopoly podcast within iTunes.
I will need to do that.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you next week.